Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags and I've got 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Wednesday, the 21st of August. Coming up on the program, business extortion shuts companies and schools in the Eastern Cape. Downbeat agriculture exports in Q2 of this year. Will Q3 be any better? We'll reflect on the legacy of the Chief Justice outgoing, Raymond Zondo, how emigration is impacting the domestic worker sector, and the astonishing growth of designer cookware as we spend more time at home and less at restaurants. Before we start and breaking in our time, South Africa's inflation rate falling to the lowest level in 3 years. That supports a case for monetary policy easing this quarter. CPI rose 4.6% in July from a year earlier, compared with 5.1% in June, the lowest level since July 2021. The South African Reserve Bank seeks to stabilize inflation and price growth expectations at 4.5%. That, you know, is the midpoint of its target range. Now, the slowdown may sway policymakers to lower borrowing costs on the 19th of September, the Monetary Policy Committee holding the benchmark interest rate at 8.25% at its last meeting, but the decision was not unanimous. Now let's move on, and businesses and schools have been targeted in Mthatha in the Eastern Cape in a spate of incidents of extortion. The police minister, Senzo Mtunu, says two specialized units will now be deployed. Kuselwa Ranchi speaks for the Eastern Cape Provincial Government and joins us on the program. And firstly then, what is behind all of this?
Jeremy, I think it's still a subject of further investigation as to whether it's just random criminals that we're dealing with, or we are dealing with a serious case of organized crime. You would understand that in the Eastern Cape, already in the last 2 years, there were some incidents reported of this, but at the time, it was targeting businesses in the main construction sites, where it was presenting itself as more of so-called SMMEs demanding the 30% that is supposed to be earmarked for them whenever there's a construction project, especially for the construction projects that are managed by government. So what they were doing at the time is, instead of asking for that 30% and there be a competitive bidding process, they will come into the contractor and ask to be given the rents and cents that are attached to that 30%. So it's something that we have been dealing with in that scenario, but it has since lowered itself down, if you like, to ordinary citizens, as we're seeing or hearing reports about schools that are targeted, churches, homes of ordinary people that are that these criminals are demanding protection fees for. It's a sad situation.
It is, and indeed.
We are hopeful that with the deployment of additional forces since last week by the South African Police Services, we are going to arrest the situation and turn around everything that we are seeing currently.
In fact, two specialized police units will be deployed. What is the specific remit there? Are you aware of that?
The expectation is that these units will go in into those areas that have been identified as hotspots. There's a combination of your tactical units, investigators that are dealing with ordinary car crime as well as serious violent crimes. There are intelligence operators. So it's a whole specialized force that will be overseen by senior officers from South African Police Services in the main from Pretoria. You would also understand that over time, with unresolved cases of this nature. There has been an erosion of trust between SAPS members and the communities in around Mthatha. So the deployment of these forces will also add that layer of trust so that communities are able to go to these officers and report some of the incidents that they are experiencing. And we are hopeful that part of what will happen with the deployment of forces from outside the area, they would be able to trust that the information that they are sharing with those detectives will not in one way or the other come back to haunt them. So we are hopeful that in the near future, this is something that would be managed and people that are behind all these incidents, they will be brought to book.
The concern, of course, is victims being able to safely report experiences without any fear of retribution.
I think that's why, and it has been a call from the provincial government, it has been a call from communities around the, especially Mthatha, that there must be a deployment of officers from outside the area to remove that layer of familiarity. And we are hopeful that they will be protected because this is going to be an investigation and an operation that is conducted by these police officers that have been deployed. So with that, Jeremy, we want to really encourage and call on people of Eastern Cape at large and people of the areas that are mostly affected to work with the police and to trust the police with information that may lead to the arrest of those that are behind these incidents.
Just a final question. Beyond Mthatha, are there other towns that the provincial government is red flagging?
The area of Gqeberha, there's been quite a lot happening there. Although in the main, we are still seeing this as a phenomenon that is affecting your business people, you would also understand, though it perhaps not in a large scale, that in the area of Buffalo City, in the last couple of months, there have been reports of doctors that are targeted and some other ordinary business people that are targeted at their places of work. And we're hoping that this operation, whilst the main focus is going to be in the area of Gqeberha or the Greater Nelson Mandela Bay, as well as your OR Tambo District Municipality. But we will not be putting our work off the other areas where we are seeing that there may be a rise of this, because we don't want a situation where these criminals will move from the areas that have been red flagged now and move to other areas of the province. So it's work right across the province, ensuring that we improve and we ensure the safety and security of citizens, because this is unfortunately something that affects businesses and it affects our economy. It also affects employment creation, and we're a province that requires growth in that area.
I am going to leave it there with my thanks. Kuselwa Ranki speaks for the Eastern Cape Provincial Government.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
I'd like to look now at the state of our agricultural exports, and although still recording a trade surplus in Q2 of this year, it was a lot slower than expected, as the total value of agriculture exports eased by 0.1% year on year, the amount to $3.37 billion. Paul Makube is with us now, senior agricultural economist at FNB Commercial. And what then were the main contributors, and welcome to you, to the decline in these numbers?
The decline was due to the weak import demand amid depressed global commodity price environment. So the combination of volume contraction as well as price that have been relatively low. So that brought down the value for the second quarter, down.
What is the overall impact then on the agricultural sector as a result of these numbers?
The overall impact on the agricultural sector is obviously that it suspects the GDP outcomes, expected GDP outcomes, but also means that, farmers have earned less than what they should have earned this year relative to last year. And this is a reflection of, tough operating conditions, but also mainly the weather that has turned negative in the 2023-2024 agricultural season.
And Paul, the key reasons for the downgrade of citrus export estimates for the current season, to what do you attribute that?
Mainly inclement weather that affected parts of Limpopo. You know, we had frost that hit that area during the critical phase of harvesting, obviously impacting on the quality for the export market. But also, we also saw the winds, strong winds in the Eastern Cape that impacted on the crops. And then the Western Cape had torrential rains that resulted in flooding in the region, impacting on volumes that were destined for the export market. So we have an overall drop in citrus export for this year.
But the big concern would be maize, wouldn't it?
Yeah, obviously, maize is already down. That's the big one. We're 19% down year on year. And this is as a result of the El Nino weather pattern that we experienced early in the season, during February, January, that resulted in the yields being, you know, reduced significantly. So the harvest is down for this year, but the outlook indicates that we are likely to see a return of the La Nina weather pattern that will see, you know, farmers getting back on the lands. We might see a substantial increase in production next year.
And Paul Makube, weather is something that is out of our control, but logistics are within our purview. The new collaboration, or the improved collaboration, between Transnet and the broader agricultural sector, do you believe that is starting to help mitigate these difficulties?
Definitely. I think the good news is that we're starting to see not only talk, but announcement of actual activity in terms of timelines, of when things are going to be done, and that raises hope that the situation will start improving. And once it improves, it will definitely have a very positive impact on the agricultural sector, but on the broader economy as well.
There would be some optimism as well, I imagine, with the private sector expected to gain access to the rail network. That surely over time is going to have a more positive impact on agricultural export.
Yes, getting, you know, especially grain back on the rail for export markets, it means smoother, you know, logistics. It means faster to the market. And obviously that will, you know, result in, you know, an improvement in output. Farmers will be able to reach the market and even increase, you know, domestic production.
Paul, finally then, a slower than expected trade surplus in Q2, as we've been discussing. Looking forward, and again, you've referenced the weather outlook. What's the general sense as far as Q3 and Q4 is concerned?
Yeah, obviously, Q3 and Q4, we still expect the trend to continue, the slow trend to continue. We've already talked about, you know, our flagship export, you know, have the export estimate is down. So obviously, the volumes and also export revenues are going to be down. And obviously, the harvest of summer grains and oilseeds are down. So, you know, a tough year for the agricultural sector this year. But next year, we expect a strong rebound in the agricultural sector.
And that strong rebound could have an impact on consumer prices or not?
Definitely. We will see moderation in prices, you know, into the second half of 2025 as, you know, conditions improve, especially on grains and oilseed side. And on the horticulture side, or dam levels are relatively, you know, more. Most of them are above 80%, especially the top 10 dams. So irrigation is not impacted at the moment, given the replenished water resources in the country. And that we are now heading into a good rainfall season. So horticulture will be the first to benefit from those conditions. And we should see, you know, the horticulture sector being the first one to actually see rebound into 2025.
Paul Makube, Senior Agricultural Economist at FNB Commercial, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
On now to the Apex Court, and the Constitutional Court is expected to hold a special ceremonial sitting for the outgoing Chief Justice Raymond Zondo. the Chief Justice leaving the bench at the end of this month. It follows 27 years of service to the judiciary, and he will hand down his final judgment on that day. So I want to take a quick moment now to look at his contribution to law in South Africa. Modidima Manya is with us, a legal commentator. Welcome to you. How, in your opinion, has Zondo's leadership shaped the Constitutional Court during his tenure?
Yes, good day, and good day to your listeners. I think it goes beyond the Constitutional Court, and it goes beyond the judiciary. You will recall that we have had a turbulent period, where the judiciary almost was under severe attack on a daily basis. And of course, it came against the background that, we had a gap because former Chief Justice Mogoeng retired and nobody was appointed immediately. Chief Justice Zondo was acting, had to be interviewed by the JSC, and things happened there. And in the midst of all these things, Chief Justice Zondo managed to navigate the judiciary to safer waters. And I think for me, that is the biggest contribution that he has made, because in that period where there was that political turbulence, we were left with only the judiciary to defend our constitutional democracy. And if anything happened, we were finished as a nation.
So a management job, no doubt, but what about significant legal contributions?
He has, and I think in the 27 years, I mean, if you read his judgments, you don't have to agree with all of them, but I've not come across one judgment that I don't think is well-researched and is not well-reasoned. But I think for me, more importantly, is the ability that the Chief Justice had, you know, to be fearless in his legal work. I mean, if you recall, in 2022, I think he led the Constitutional Court to deliver the judgment in this very emotive matter of Walus Janus and his parole. You know, the political environment would have influenced anybody who was not as strong as he is. But he applied the law. He reasoned the law. He explained the law. He explained why this judgment is good for every one of the people who are sentenced to life imprisonment. So he has made a very significant improvement. I've benefited quite a lot reading his judgments.
But it will always be the State Capture Commission that stands front and center.
I think it should be one of the things. And I think the significance of Judge Zondo's contribution in the State Capture, and we now know that many other judges were approached and they were not willing. But he took the bull by its horns. He stood there. He could have had to make adverse findings against a sitting president or a speaker. But he did his work to the best of his ability. And he has produced a very quality report that all of us, we will be able to move forward. And it will be part of our history of where we almost destroyed our nation.
And now a new legal era approaches. How does the new Chief Justice build on that formidable foundation that you've just outlined for me?
Yes, I think one must first commend the president, you know, for ensuring such a smooth and seamless transition from one Chief Justice to the other. I think we needed this in the past term. But remember, Chief Justice Maya is a solid powerhouse legally in her own right. She's a solid leader in her own right. I mean, she's led the Supreme Court of Appeal without fail. Now, you're actually moving from one good person to the other. You know, what you expect is that she can just make it better than what Chief Justice Zondo is leaving behind.
The state of the judiciary that Zondo leaves behind, it's in a better place, isn't it, as you've referenced?
Yes, it is in a better place. But I think we must bear in mind that, judges and most of the judges, you know, bar where we pick up problems, are hardworking people working under very, very, very torturous circumstances, you know. So it's not necessarily just the function of the Chief Justice, but it's the function of the commitment of the rest of the members of the judiciary across the board who are really working under very, if you are a practitioner, you would know that you would go to court on an urgent motion and you find a judge having to deal with 10 urgent applications in one single day. you know. And I think the performance of the judiciary must also be viewed in that context. The workload is not as easy as you wish. But I think the importance is that Chief Justice Zondo has built up, and this we must also give credit to his predecessor, Chief Justice Mogoeng, who had institutionalized this culture of reducing reserve judgments, because that's the biggest fault line in our judicial system.
Legal practitioner, commentator and writer Modi Dima Manya, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
A new report indicates that a fifth of domestic workers have lost their jobs over the past year, a significant portion due to their employers either emigrating or leaving the country. According to Sweep South's 2024 domestic worker report, 21% of workers report having lost their job in the past year. More now from Sweep South's Group Chief Operating Officer Luke Kannemeyer. Luke, welcome to you. And what specific factors then are driving the continued job losses?
The primary factors we're seeing driving losses is primarily affordability and then the relocation of clients, mainly local, but also international driving that.
This relocation of clients, is this getting more and more pronounced?
Well, I think last year we did see this become a bigger factor. It was the leading factor, which I think was a post-COVID dynamic. But we're now seeing affordability is affecting both total job losses, but even those who remain employed, around 36% have lost some of their work due to affordability.
So could you elaborate then on the real impact of emigration and I guess semigration as well, as many people perhaps in Johannesburg, where I'm talking from, are moving to the coast? What is that having, or what impact is that having on the domestic worker job market?
Well, when we see with emigration is that those are jobs that just won't be recovered. And then we see a sector here that since its COVID peak is down by around 15%, that's a factor that's then removed. In semigration, we do see significant number here who are moving obviously to other towns where they're likely to get domestic work, but also a lot then are looking to downsize, are looking to contain costs. And that then is also a driving factor when you see a reduction in jobs.
And how are domestic workers then adjusting to this new reality or changing landscape that you've outlined?
I think this is where we're seeing more piecemeal work amongst domestic workers. The notion of full-time or live-in work as a domestic worker may hope to get eventually or as a first prize, that's less and less of an option. And increasingly, we've seen that has plummeted. And yeah, in terms of adjustments, it's evident that with the lack of recovery in the markets, I think many are having to find other means of employment, many struggling to do so. And this is an alarming trend that we do hope that we can address this in the country.
So given that decline that you've outlined, particularly post-pandemic, are there any measures that could be implemented to restore employment levels, or are we just going to see a gradual erosion?
I think one of the larger factors here is that the employers of domestic workers are under pressure, and that pulls through to domestic workers themselves. And I think that's where we can look at factors. So we can look at potential looking at like tax breaks for those who are employing people to encourage the employment of domestic workers. I think that there used to be a way where domestic work was regulated across the country by regions where the minimum rates differed, understanding that the cost of living was significantly different across the country. And so that then allowed better setting of rates and, you know, then greater affordability within those smaller regions.
Often this is a sector that is not supported and is in many ways hidden. And I'm assuming, Luke, that there are not sufficient support systems that would be available for those in domestic service who have lost their jobs, either due to employers moving or financial difficulties, as we've discussed.
Absolutely. I think while South Africa has really amazing legislation here that's intended to protect domestic workers, the access to that is highly limited. So UIF and even COIDA, so that's the Occupational Health and Safety, are said to apply to domestic workers. But the take-up rates of that are very, very low. And that is primarily driven from what we've seen, that for domestic employers, these systems are incredibly difficult to work with. And that is where we hope that with government intervention and the use of technology, we can ease the access of that so that in the eventual loss of a job or, you know, pregnancy, et cetera, we do see that domestic workers are not in such a precarious position.
As far as the survey of yours is concerned, do you compare the findings to other sectors in South Africa? And if you do, is it any better or is it any worse?
So I think that isn't currently within the scope of the survey. I think where we've, that's an interesting trend to look at. We've obviously seen that general employment has gone to its worst levels ever. We've seen somewhat of an improvement and that then stabilizing around a number. But I think the 15% drop in domestic workers, that's a slight increase year on year. We actually had seen a much larger decline last year. That is one of the industries that's certainly most impacted post-COVID, with no recovery or very little recovery seen.
Luke, you've indicated your concern as far as these numbers are concerned. What, in your opinion, would be the long-term implications for this sector if this trend of job losses continues, and there is every indication that it will?
I think this sector is often downplayed in terms of its importance in the country. I think something we've seen at Sweep South is that domestic work is often an enabler of domestic workers, and often they're on average four dependents getting better fortunes in life. You're getting education, getting further job opportunities. And when we see that that basic employment is being eroded, around 11% of Black women who are employed are working as domestic workers. That then is a larger burden on the social security system in South Africa. And in turn, then we will see a knock-on effect in terms of taxes. And we know that that's something that's increasingly limited in terms of our base. And so this is where urgent addressing of these dynamics, and, you know, us really trying to look at a recovery and a strategy as a country as a whole in terms of economic recovery, I think that's the only longer term factor that's going to see us see pull through and growth in the sector once more.
I am going to leave it there. From Sweep South, the Group Chief Operating Officer, Luke Kannemeyer, thank you very much indeed. I do appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the statistics portal Statista estimates revenue generated in the kitchenware market in 2024 was 485 million rand, and wealthy consumers are now buying designer kitchenware, many of the leading labels like La Crusade selling single items for thousands of rands. I'm joined now by Greg Orban, a research analyst at Euromonitor International. And Greg, the trend of home cooking, how's it influencing sales here?
So the current economic climate has forced many South African consumers to opt to cook at home rather than dining out. That's obviously had a positive impact on a lot of cookware. This includes ovenware, stovetop cookware. They're spending more time in the kitchen. They're wanting to cook on good products. So we're seeing that have a very positive impact on the sales of these products. There's also a health and wellness trend, and a lot of consumers are opting to cook at home due to the health benefits of making their own food, which is also positively impacting on these products. And then more recently, the absence of load shedding has steered consumers away from takeout and fast food because they've been able to cook at home. And this is also having a positive impact on these products.
And no doubt this is a very sustainable trend.
Yes, definitely. I think moving forward, specifically, we've seen globally the health and wellness trend will impact these sales positively, and people will start spending more time in the kitchen and wanting to cook on premium sort of products.
Do you think that the market itself is keeping up with this fairly voracious demand? In other words, are there more products coming to the shelf?
Are having to innovate and produce these products, and I think they'll continue to do so. We've seen quite a big trend within the private label offering of some of the big retailers in South Africa. The ones that come to mind are Mr. Price, Woolworths, and they are investing large amounts of money into their private label offering, increasing the quality. which is sort of keeping up with demand that the consumers have.
That's an interesting one, because often in the past, private label brands have been seen as inferior, but that's not only changing, I would imagine, when it comes to the utensil side of things, but more broadly across all types of brands that can be found in supermarkets and home stores.
Yes, definitely. There's a very big private label offering amongst the dining, so that includes beverageware, cutlery, dinnerware. And as I mentioned, they're continuously improving these products, and people are sort of perceiving them to be of a better quality. And a lot of South Africans are seeking value, and these products give them this value while also providing quality.
So how are the brands themselves responding to this in terms of volume of availability as well as marketing?
I think the sort of the more established brands will obviously continue to manufacture these products, and they are keeping up. With regards to the smaller brands, obviously there is a bigger demand for them now. As I said, the bigger retailers will be investing a lot of money into this, and they should be upping their supply of these in the future and sort of moving forward.
And Greg Orban, tell me, the sale of these products, is it all happening online, or is there also a bricks and mortar element to all of this?
There's definitely sort of, or what we're seeing is a lot of retailers sort of taking an omni-channel approach. So this is obviously providing their products online through an e-commerce platform, and then also through brick and mortar stores. Obviously, post-pandemic, we've seen a big increase in e-commerce sales. And when you think of retailers, the likes of Yappy Chef come to mind. They've got a very big sort of e-commerce platform to provide their products on, but more stores are popping up. And for certain products, the consumers still prefer to go in-store to sort of feel, touch, see these products before buying them. But there's definitely been a huge surge in e-commerce sales across the homeware sort of market.
And Greg, tell me, is this a worldwide trend, or is South Africa either leading or coming late to the party?
With regards to e-commerce, I think South Africa would be lagging a bit behind the rest of the world. So there's huge sort of growth potential there through sales through those sort of platforms. But as I said, e-commerce is continuously increasing, and with the likes of Amazon entering the South African market now, it'll only continue to grow.
And if you look particularly at the sale of kitchenware at this high end, the restaurant trade would surely be having to take notice of this. They would be concerned there, no doubt.
Yeah, definitely. Our sort of scope of research looks more into the consumer side. But I would imagine that the restaurant industry would definitely have to take note of that.
All right, Greg Orban, thank you very much indeed. Research analyst at Euromonitor International. I appreciate your time today. And just before I leave you, on our online poll today, we reported earlier on the legacy of the outgoing Chief Justice Raymond Zondo. And my question to you today, a legal giant, solid in performance, or could have done more? If you have a view, either go to our X or LinkedIn pages. That's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.